Dungeons and Demons. Cosmina sat down quickly at a small triangular table in the food court and immediately began scanning the room.
Look, she hissed to Neville. That's Geth Kincarnate, the head of the governors. Do you know him?
No,
Neville replied irritably. I know we spent all night shagging. Do you care about that?
You should get to know him,
she told him authoritatively as she smoothed out the pink silk tablecloth.
It is most important who one knows. You should work for the ministry, she added excitedly. You know important people here. The minister would find you a good position.
Neville scowled at her.
I like Hogwarts, he said defensively, and I just got made head of Gryffindor House.
There is nothing prestigious in academia,
she replied dismissively.
Your friend Lupin obviously knew this. He became an Auror, which brought him connections with the ministry he would not have had teaching defense.
That isn't why he became an Auror, Neville said heatedly. He became an Auror to protect people. He hates politics. He only puts up with the ministry because of Kingsley and Arthur.
Cosmina gave him a disbelieving look that clearly stated no one could possibly be this foolish.
It's true, Neville reiterated doggedly. He and Sirius Black turned the whole atrium pink during the first war and put a dead troll in Fudge's chair, he added with satisfaction, and Cosmina's mouth dropped open in horror.
This is known,
she said incredulously.
Of course it's known, Neville replied impatiently. Kingsley thinks it's funny.
Just like it's known, you can't talk about anything but politics and your job. I mean, you could have said, that was nice or something last night after we did it, instead of getting out your work files to study. That was totally romantic.
I do not understand the British,
she frowned.
People behave in appalling ways, people in high positions. The minister should learn how to discipline his people.
Neville gave her a furious look.
Who are you to judge us? He said hotly.
I know a good deal more about politics than you, she replied haughtily. I am the Romanian ambassador.
Who cares? Neville said rudely. There are lots of ambassadors. They come, they go, he added loftily. And maybe I'll drop by Kingsley's office and mention that you think he can't discipline his people. That'll be great for your career.
Cosmina promptly burst into tears, and an elderly elf scuttled over to the table behind them, his enormous ears quivering with excitement.
I'm sorry, she wailed and twisted her green silk napkin furiously. I've said all the wrong things to you. Oh, I make a mess of everything,
she added in a tragic voice. I'm a great git, Neville thought gloomily. I'm making a woman cry. Somebody I slept with last night. I'm a bigger git than Percy.
Well, it's just, I don't know what to think about you, he blurted out in a bewildered voice. I don't know if you really like me or you care about who I know. You didn't even say anything to me last night after we... You know.
I've given you the wrong impression, she responded fervently. Last night was wonderful. I was too embarrassed to speak of it, that is all. I was afraid you would think badly of me.
I don't know why you'd think that, just because you met me at the door in a see-through nightgown and dragged me off to your bedroom without even saying hello or do you want to go out sometime.
I never know what to say to men, she continued pleadingly. I've not dated anyone since my husband died, and we married when I was very young. All I know to speak of is my work,
she finished miserably. Neville felt quite horrible now, especially since she said last night was wonderful.
Well, that's okay, he replied in an embarrassed voice. I shouldn't have gotten mad. I'm exactly the same as you. I can't think of things to say to girls, so I go on about plants. Last year, Professor Vectra set me up with her great-niece Matilda, and I kept nattering on about my blooming Albicinius until she jumped up and ran out of the restaurant.
I would never do that,
Cosmina said firmly.
This girl was very rude. I like to hear about plants, and I would love to see your greenhouses,
she added enthusiastically, and Neville brightened.
Yeah, he said cheerfully. That'd be great. Why don't you come over after work?
I would love that,
she replied demurely as she trailed him to the departure areas.
I'll be thinking of you. All day,
she told him hopefully, and Neville smiled.
Me too, he responded quickly and kissed her goodbye.
Once outside, he stood in the alley for a few moments with his hands in his cloak pockets, looking up at an eagle as it wheeled about in the cold, gray winter sky. I finally got what I always wanted, he thought, feeling somewhat bewildered. A pretty girlfriend who's sweet and smart and cares about me. I'm definitely in love with her. I'd be really happy. Why don't I feel happier? Well, because I'm always feeling sorry for myself, that's why, he told himself angrily. I've got a really good job, and Mum's getting better now, and I've got a girlfriend, too, and I'm going to be happy. He watched the eagle as it glided effortlessly on the currents of the chilly wind, and felt an inexplicable pang of loss when it soared out of view. When Lupin arrived at Radu's castle, he discovered breakfast prepared for him at the main dining table, which he might have interpreted as a friendly gesture, except for the fact that two decaying corpses were propped up in chairs on either side of his steak and eggs, and an impaled toddler was dripping blood down a cold iron spike at the head of the table.
"Oh my God,"
he said wearily as he sat down and buried his head in his hands. Radu, who was sitting haughtily at the end of the table, ripping the head off a live chicken with his teeth, gave him a bored look.
"I will not change my modus operandi simply because you are here," he informed him contemptuously. "Quit carrying on like that. It is good to eat with the dead."
Lupin looked up.
"What?" he said disbelievingly. "I could have gone my entire life without hearing that sentence."
"Do not dare speak to me in that manner," Radu hissed frigidly. "Eating with the dead terrifies the servants. They pass this information along to the villagers, and in turn it is disseminated throughout the country. And you are extremely ill-tempered in the morning," he said icily. "In fact, I find you simply intolerable."
Lupin gave his rotted seatmates a disgusted look, but started eating.
"I'm not in the mood for you either," he muttered irritably. "I've been up since 5 a.m.
"Obviously you are exceptionally lazy," Radu told him scornfully. "I arise at 4. That is when one should arise," he added patronizingly.
"You wake me up at 4 tomorrow, and I'll kill you,"
Lupin snarled and snatched up his coffee.
"Why would I wish to awaken you at 4? Radu replied in a venomous tone. "I cannot stand you at this hour."
He slammed his chalice down on the table with a bang, and blood sloshed over the rim, forming a bright red ring on the elegant white linen tablecloth.
"Look, I'm sorry,"
Lupin sighed and pointed his wand at the stain.
"Scourgify, I'm not a morning person. I apologize."
Radu's response to this was to curl up his lip in a satisfied fashion.
"You are not a person at all," he replied spitefully. "And that color you are wearing does not suit you,"
he announced decisively.
"Change into something else."
Lupin gave him an incredulous look.
"You did not say that. It's not possible. You just said that."
Radu raised an eyebrow.
"And why is it not possible?"
he responded coolly.
"Who in the hell are you to tell me what to wear? Or order me to change my damn clothes?"
"You are inexcusably insolent,"
Radu spat out angrily.
"I tell you, I will not have it. You will not speak unless spoken to."
If I look at him again, I'll kill him, Lupin thought, and turned to glare at the corpse on his left instead, a half-decayed old woman with wild gray hair and empty eye sockets, and the body immediately burst into flames.
"First you send me bodies, then you burn up my bodies,"
Radu told him resentfully.
"What is the point of this?"
"Spone,"
Lupin said hastily, and the fire went out.
"Damn, she really looks bad now,"
he added in an impressed voice, as the charred corpse twisted up gruesomely in its chair.
"Yes, you have quite improved her,"
his host replied complacently.
"Perhaps I will sit her on the porch to greet my visitors."
An 8-foot goblin with oily green skin and bulging eyes scuttled into the room, his gargantuan bare feet slapping loudly on the emerald and yellow hand-painted tiled floor, as he presented Lupin with a silk-lined lacquered mahogany bread basket stuffed with a dozen different loaves.
"I bring you bread,"
he stated unnecessarily in a breathily lustful tone.
"Right,"
Lupin replied uncomfortably and set the basket beside his plate.
"Thank you, that's excellent. You may go now,"
he finished hopefully when the goblin did not move. The goblin, however, appeared rooted to the spot.
"Beautiful,"
he groaned suddenly in a deep and rattling voice.
"You are so beautiful."
13-inch webbed fingers reached out and greedily entwined themselves in Lupin's long blonde hair, and he leapt to his feet in a fraction of a second.
"Don't touch me," he shouted with a horrified expression. "Damn, this is one creepy-ass castle."
"I beg your forgiveness," the goblin said despondently. "I find your hair most attractive. I find you most attractive,"
it whimpered wretchedly.
"I was overcome. I beg your forgiveness."
"Don't worry about it," Lupin muttered and sat back down. "It's fine. Please don't do it again."
He glanced at Radu, whose face was completely expressionless.
"Come here,"
Radu said silkily to the goblin.
"Come. Come. No. Closer."
The goblin moved slowly towards Radu with the countenance of mortal terror on his broad, ugly face.
"I plead for mercy," he wailed frantically. "I beseech your majesty's pardon. Forgive me, your lordship. It will never happen again."
"No," Radu responded coldly. "It will certainly never happen again."
In the blink of an eye, he sprang from his chair and sank his fangs viciously into the artery on the side of the goblin's neck. Lupin whipped out his wand, but did not bother shouting a spell, as the damage was quite obviously already done. The goblin lay twitching painfully on the floor, gasping in a strangled fashion as great spurts of his own blood shot to the ceiling and then splattered back down across his terrified face. Radu yawned and picked up his morning paper.
"Go and get the prophet for my British friend here," he ordered one of the servants with a frown. "It should have already been at his plate."
"Yes, yes, your majesty, your lordship, your excellency, begging your gracious forgiveness," the man practically howled and fled the room, and the goblin let out a great shuddering sigh and lay still.
"What the hell is wrong with you?" Lupin barked out angrily. "He apologized. He backed off. There wasn't any reason for that." "Do not presume to correct me,"
Radu replied in a glacial tone.
"You are the most ungrateful beast I've ever known." "How in the hell am I ungrateful?" Lupin snapped back. "And what's it got to do with you murdering that pathetic creature?"
"Normally, I would have merely struck him," Radu responded coolly. "I did not like him bothering you. However, do you care about this?"
he said petulantly.
"What?"
Lupin replied in a genuinely baffled tone.
"What the fuck are you saying?"
Radu flung his paper to the floor.
"You do not care about this," he announced wrathfully. "This is because you care for nothing but yourself. I cannot endure your selfishness another moment. I tell you, I will not tolerate it." "It's my fault you killed this fellow,"
Lupin said disbelievingly.
"Because I'm selfish. This is what you're saying."
"Yes," Ryder replied in a satisfied manner. "That is it exactly. For once you have managed to grasp my meaning," he said disdainfully. "And I will allow you to beg forgiveness for your earlier comments,"
he announced magnanimously,
"as I am inclined to be gracious this morning."
"Tell him that,"
Lupin responded nastily and motioned toward the goblin's blood-soaked body.
"Don't think I'll ever beg your forgiveness, you evil son of a bitch. You're the one who needs to be begging forgiveness. And not from me."
Radu put his hand menacingly on the wand in his pocket.
"Go on," Lupin snarled. "Go on, I'll torch up your great bullying ass and put your charred corpse on the porch beside that dead woman. That dead woman," he continued furiously, his voice raising as Radu's face turned purple with rage, "who was undoubtedly your kind-hearted old nanny that you killed in her sleep when you were 6 years old because she combed your hair the wrong way and you couldn't fucking tolerate it,"
he screamed. Barnabas strolled into the room, glanced from Radu to Lupin to the dead goblin, and hurried right back out of it.
"Get back in this room!" Radu called after him.
"I do not wish to interrupt your breakfast," Barnabas blurted out quickly as he inched his way back in. "I apologize, your lordship. I'm extremely sorry. Extremely sorry."
Lupin, however, did not appear the slightest bit sorry, since he was stomping about the table, kicking over every single chair.
"Do not distress yourself," Radu declared arrogantly to Barnabas. "I shall allow it. And you will leave my table now,"
he told Lupin in a positively vicious tone of voice.
"Gladly," Lupin shouted and snatched up his cloak. "And don't think I'll ever come back to this godforsaken castle again. This place is the eighth layer of hell."
Radu curled up his lip in a most superior fashion.
"No, there is no need for you to return," he replied haughtily. "You are known for being slow to anger. I've attempted to provoke you into rage for a month,"
he announced in a satisfied voice.
"I've accomplished my goal, as I always do. You may go."
He waved his hand dismissively. "I hate you more than Voldemort," Lupin thought to himself, and began picking up the chairs.
"Well, I'm sorry you've had to carry it on for a month," he told Radu courteously when he'd finished. "I'm sure it's been quite tiresome for you."
Radu narrowed his eyes and frowned at him.
"If you'd done your research properly, however, you'd have known I'm bad-tempered in the morning,"
Lupin continued in a contrite manner,
"and invited me to breakfast much sooner. Would have saved you a good deal of time, you know, enduring my presence and all that."
Radu stared at him ominously, his dark eyes flashing.
"It's extremely important to research your subject thoroughly,"
Lupin said and shook his head sadly, as if overcome by the depth of Radu's blind, dumb ignorance.
"There's nothing more important when dealing with an enemy, but I'm sure I needn't give you lectures on defense,"
he added apologetically.
"Even if this month's Defense Digest did name me the world's most dangerous wizard, it doesn't mean anything, really."
He shrugged. Radu appeared speechless with rage by this pronouncement.
"Anyway, I'm sure you'll do better next time,"
he finished kindly, his expression so angelic Barnabas momentarily pictured a halo above his head.
"I wish you a good day. Barnabas, many thanks for your kindness."
He gave them a sweeping bow and sauntered off whistling cheerfully, and Radu came after him so quickly his feet did not even seem to touch the ground.
"You will apologize to me," he snarled in a deadly tone as he pulled up behind him, "or you will never leave this castle alive."
"I will not," Lupin said defiantly, "and I will leave this castle, and you'll be the one who's not alive."
"I say you will apologize," Radu reiterated venomously, "and you will do it now."
"Fuck off!" Lupin yelled, and they both screeched to a halt.
"You will dearly regret your words," Radu hissed as they began circling one another threateningly. "You filthy scourge of a beast! You repugnant and vile creature! You son of a pox-riddled, maggot-infested whore!" he yelled wrathfully. "Go suck your own damn dick, you undead fiend of a motherfucking bloody bat!" Lupin screamed back.
A loud thud resounded from behind them, a sound Lupin imagined to be the wise Barnabas hitting the deck.
"Crucio! Stupefy! Tarantalo verignosum! Impedimenta! Explota!"
Blasts of green light shot furiously through the air, blowing huge holes in the chunks of stone that made up the corridor walls. Radu leapt almost upside down, turned a graceful circle, and darted to one side, while Lupin dove on the ground, rolled over, and sprang back up to his feet.
"Aviso pugno!"
Radu yelled out triumphantly, and a flock of enormous pigeons burst forth from his wand, diving at Lupin with hideous shrieks as they pecked and clawed viciously at his face.
"Son of a bitch!" Lupin yelled wildly. "Confringo!"
The birds blew into pieces, showering both of them with feathers, bones, and blood, and out of the corner of his eye, Lupin saw Barnabas crawling backwards out of the corridor on his hands and knees.
"Crucio!" Radu roared. "Aguamenti!"
Lupin shouted as he jumped to the side, and an ice-cold downpour of water drenched Radu from head to foot.
"I don't like birds," Lupin growled, "and vampires don't like getting wet."
Apparently, this was true.
"Avada Kedavra!"
Radu screamed frenetically.
"Hagala fiendfire!"
Lupin bellowed at the same moment, and Barnabas, who had scuttled an impressive 200 feet backwards on all fours, threw his arms over his head. The spells deflected off one another onto the walls of the cave, setting off a blinding explosion of brilliant green and vivid red light, a spectacularly deafening blast, and then a violent crashing downpour of rock.
"Well, shit," Lupin thought to himself.
The stone floor caved in, and torrents of rock pelted him brutally as he plunged through corridor after lower corridor, each giving way just as they broke his fall, and after a final sickening drop through what seemed a 100-foot abyss of blackness, he slammed to the ground.
"So," Quentin said casually, as Solange looked up at him from where she sat cross-legged on his bed, surrounded by dozens of photographs, travel blogs, and itineraries she had printed off on her computer. "Shall I tell my travel agent to reserve one room or two for this trip?"
"Well,"
she replied nervously and twisted her hair.
"I don't know."
Quentin gave her an incredulous look.
"What? How the fuck does she not know?"
"Obviously she knows. Apparently she wants me to guess. That or she hasn't a clue. And if she doesn't, she needs to fucking get one."
"Either way, I don't know," was his least favorite response from anyone about anything. And in this situation, rather humiliating.
"That's what I'll tell my travel agent then," he barked back, "when he asks me how many rooms. I don't know. And he can pass that along to the reservations desk. Number of rooms? We don't know."
"This is exactly why I don't know," Solange wailed. "You might be really sweet to me, or you might act like a great giant ass."
"Give me a number," he demanded. "Don't think I'm playing these games with you, you fucking tease," he added to himself.
"Two," Solange shrieked and snatched up the papers. "Two, on different floors."
Timothy blearily squinted his eyes open and scowled at the sound of someone stumbling into their door room.
"Tim,"
Esther's voice hissed from the other side of the bed curtains.
"Wake up, wake up."
All of his roommates began grumbling and groaning loudly.
"Get up, Tim,"
Serena Brown chimed in pleadingly.
"I'm going to wake up Alex."
"What?" Timothy muttered peevishly.
"What time is it?" "That doesn't matter,"
Esther whispered angrily.
"Get up." "It's really important,"
shrieked a loud, whining voice, and Timothy shuddered. "It's Dorcas. This is the worst night ever. I'm trying to sleep, and girls are waking me up, and it's not because they want to snog me or anything. And they brought that freak Dorcas." 10 minutes later, Tim, Alex, Melvin, and Dugan were sitting on the floor in their bathrobes with sullen expressions, while Esther and Serena spoke animatedly and Dorcas frowned at them all. In her arms, she clutched a 50-pound black leather book with demons and exorcisms carved in frankly terrifying 6-inch letters on the spine.
"It's true, Tim,"
Esther said stubbornly.
"'Tis not," Timothy replied defiantly.
The girls were apparently under the impression that Professor Trelawney's red cat, Incense, was possessed by a demon, and that furthermore, the boys were supposed to do something about it.
How can you not believe in demons? Serena wailed. When you've got a cursed shirt in the corner of your room.
All seven of them glanced towards the back of the room, where Alex's shirt remained cowering, just as it had ever since Dragomir had shouted at it. Clive, whose bed was nearest the shirt, had piled up stacks of potting soil he'd nicked from one of the greenhouses so that he wouldn't see it, should he waken from at night from his sleep. Which, Tim thought to himself, was a highly unlikely possibility.
It's cursed, not possessed by a demon, Alex said impatiently as Clive let out a loud snore. And it doesn't do anything anyway. I'm more worried about those socks, he shivered. You know, not knowing where they are and all.
The purple socks had not been seen since Timothy's near strangulation, something all of the Gryffindors found rather unnerving.
Back to cat! Back to that cat!
Dorcas shrilled in her grating voice. Let's stay on the subject here!
All four boys gave her a disgusted look, and Melvin's purple-toed turnip let out aloud in a disapproving belch.
That toad's disgusting, Dorcas snapped. He's always belching and farting.
This unfortunately was true. Turnip was quite gassy.
It's a Christmas present, Melvin announced loftily and clutched his toad possessively in his hand. And I like him.
What he also liked, he thought to himself, was that the tag attached to the toad's box had come in handwriting quite familiar to Melvin from the herbology blackboard.
To Melvin, from an anonymous friend. Happy Christmas.
Melvin, Tim, and Alex looked at the girls, and then one another with exasperation. Why Serena, a pretty dreamy sort of girl who loved romance books, perfume, and makeup, and Esther, who was smart, tomboyish, and fun, allowed Dorcas to tag about with them, the boys had no idea. Dorcas was a squat lump of a girl with a protuberant nose, dreadful skin, thick orange glasses that clashed hideously with her poofy maroon hair, a personality that resembled someone's bad-tempered spinster great aunt, and worst of all, the beau. The bow was an innocuous-appearing 2-inch lavender silk hair bow, which secured Dorcas's yanked back hair to the top of her scalp. The terrifying thing about the bow was that Dorcas had never, ever, ever been seen without it, and all attempts to remove it had proven not only futile, but dangerous. Several seventh years had attempted to remove the bow from her head with various spells, and nearly drowned when the giant squid leapt out and pulled them into the lake. A large green cactus-shaped object blossomed from Tim's left ear when he attempted to snatch the bow off her head the first time, and a nasty burn appeared on the side of his arm after his second try. Professor Flitwick himself had given it a go, and after 30 minutes of determined charms work, had only succeeded in turning himself into a giant, double-ended newt, while Dorcas, bow firmly in place, had sat calmly at her desk with a superior and self-satisfied smirk on her face. The boys had turned to Professor Longbottom next, and after a good deal of begging, he tossed his trowel aside in class one day and pointed his wand at Dorcas.
"Ratio objecto!" he commanded
in a confident voice.
"Ow!"
Doris squealed angrily, but the bow did not move.
You almost got it loose!" Melvin had yelled proudly. "That's better than anyone else has done!"
When he turned to see how Professor Longbottom had taken this remark, however, he discovered that his herbology teacher was now a large puddle of bubbling yellow slime on the floor. They decided next that Melvin should approach Dragomir for assistance, since he was known to be his general favorite, which only meant that Dragomir had yet to attempt to physically torture him, did not shout quite as loudly or nastily at him as he did the others, and would occasionally deign to allow Melvin to speak. Melvin had bravely raised his hand during defense and asked in a reverent tone if Dragomir would be so kind as to impart his wisdom on the subject of removing an apparently unremovable object.
"Are you speaking of an object to which a permanent sticking charm has been applied?"
Dragomir had replied crossly.
"We don't know, sir,"
Melvin said earnestly.
"Many permanent sticking charms, despite their appellation, can be reversed,"
Dragomir intoned sourly.
"The important matter is who has done the charm. You cannot reverse it if it has been done by a wizard more powerful than yourself."
After class, Melvin gathered up his courage and approached Dragomir's desk with a formal, sweeping bow.
"If I may have a word, sir,"
he enunciated carefully.
"5 minutes,"
Dragomir snapped and glared at his textbooks, causing them all to blunder hastily into his large eel-skin satchel.
Another spell couldn't have been done by wizard more skilled than you,"
Melvin pronounced obsequiously, although he imagined this was probably true.
"Maybe you can remove it, sir. It's scaring us,"
he shuddered.
I do not concern myself with hair bows, Dragomir replied in an outraged tone. Professor Longbottom is an imbecile, and I cannot imagine what Flitwick was thinking. He snatched up his eelskin satchel. Besides that, Morville, the bow is obviously there for a reason.
This statement had left the students in a state of near hysteria and prompted a furious debate among the castle inhabitants as to the reason for the bow.
Nearly had the snicks, as her head will fall off without that bow, a terrified Hufflepuff whispered to another at breakfast. Barnabas the Balmy says she's really a zombie,
the Ravenclaw Seeker told Tim knowingly.
Peeves told me she must be an Inferi,
Pineas informed the other Slytherins.
Coach Weasley thinks it gives her special evil powers,
Robert Pembroke muttered to a fellow seventh year.
Professor Trelawney says it's keeping her alive,
Clive announced dourly to a group of second years who were following him down the charms corridor.
Shred it into tea leaves. Well, that bow goes, she goes,
he added darkly, and the second years gasped. Melvin's thoughts about the bow were interrupted when Dorcas slammed the book down on the floor with a loud thud.
Now, I've read through this entire book twice, she announced virtuously. I found out how to do it.
The stupid, Alex grumbled. Nobody thinks that cat's possessed by a demon.
I heard Professor Evans telling Dragomir, Esther responded heedily. And then Dragomir sent to Professor Evans. Everyone knows this, you great fool. If you've been hiding your head in a cauldron, Hagrid knew it when he was in first year. The cat was here then.
The boys exchanged looks of alarms.
And you know who else was here besides that demon-possessed cat when Hagrid was a first year?
Serena squealed dramatically, her shiny golden-brown curls bobbing with excitement.
Voldemort!
Yeah,
Melvin nodded excitedly.
I bet it started out as his cat.
That isn't in the books, Alex replied stubbornly.
Apparently out of loyalty to the Weasley family honor, Alex believed almost nothing that was not in the books, something which annoyed Tim greatly. He even gave Lupin suspicious glances when he visited, as if he were merely pretending to be alive.
Ginny didn't know everything, Tim told Alex for what he was sure was the millionth time. Nobody knows all the secrets of the castle, except for the Marauders, he pronounced definitively. They knew everything.
That's what I thought, too,
Esther said happily and clapped her hands. Timothy gazed worshipfully at her sparkling green eyes, Cupid's bow pink mouth, and the long silver blonde platinum braid that trailed down the back of her forbidden tight pink t-shirt and muggle blue jeans, which showed off her slender, newly blossomed curves to their best advantage. I love you, he thought dreamily, and restrained himself from sighing. I love you, I love you, I love you. If I could kiss you, I would die of happiness. I would die right here on the spot. Not only was Esther the smartest, bravest, and pretty girl in the world, she was also simply the best girl in the world. She could climb a turret as quickly as Tim, would throw a dung bomb into the Slytherin common room and brag about it at breakfast, and found fake farting noises and jokes about excrement hilarious.
So, I wrote and asked him, Esther announced proudly, and I'll read you what
she said mysteriously. Wrote who? Alex demanded. George?
No, Esther replied impatiently. My dad always says go straight to the top, she nodded definitively. That's what he says. So I wrote Lupin.
Esther was fond of quoting her father, whom she apparently found a godlike creature, who contained a treasure house of wisdom, even if he just looked like a young and skinny fellow with glasses that worked in the apothecary shop to everyone else.
What'd you do that? Timothy said with a frown. I would have written to him for you. He's my godfather.
Yeah, he thought pensively. Then we could have laid down on the floor next to each other while we thought up the letter. And maybe you'd have had your hair out of the braid, and some of it would have fallen across the parchment. And I could have said, careful, don't get ink on your hair, and brushed it back over your shoulders. And then you would have turned your head and kissed me, because I know you want to kiss me. Esther ignored his protests, since she thought Timothy was the most conceited and obnoxious boy she'd ever known.
So, I can write if I want, she replied stubbornly. Now listen up. It says, Dear Miss Claridge, of course I remember meeting you, and you needn't worry about bothering me. Curiosity is an admirable quality. In this instance, however, it won't kill the cat.
What's that mean? Duggan burst out. He's talking in riddles.
Let me finish, Esther yelled. Don't worry yourself about incense. He's certainly possessed by a demon, but he isn't a demon himself, and I wouldn't recommend trying to exorcise him. Apparently it's a powerful demon. He ate a first year once. Nasty business.
The group let out a gasp of horror, and Esther gave them a triumphant look.
Shh! Here's the rest. It's all been hushed up, so please keep it to yourself. Besides that, Sybil's quite fond of him. Best wishes, Remus Lupin.
He's joking, right? But the first you're getting eaten. Dugan laughed nervously. Right?
Of course not joking, Dorcas said derisively. Who would joke about something like that?
He's not joking, Timothy intoned gloomily. I can tell when he's joking. Anyway, his face brightened considerably.
I guess it really is possessed by a demon. This is totally cool. Keep me that book. No,
Dorcas squealed as he tried unsuccessfully to prise it from her hands.
It's my book, and I told you, I know how to do it. I've made copies of the instructions for everyone, she told them bossily. Memorize them, and we'll do it tomorrow at midnight. It must be done at midnight,
she announced in a loud, funereal voice. I hate her, Timothy thought wrathfully, and I'm going to get that bow off her head if it's the last thing I do.
We better go back to bed,
Serena whispered worriedly, and Alex cast her a love-struck look as the girls trotted out of the room. I love Serena, he moaned desperately once they were safely out of earshot.
I love her. I'm going to die because I love her so much.
That's stupid, Tim replied irritably.
Love's for girls. I just want to shag somebody. Awfully early,
Solange yawned the next morning, as MacDonald tossed her suitcases, makeup bags, and totes into the back seat of the green Land Rover.
You're the one that wanted to drive to Würzburg in one day,
Quentin snapped. Solange gave him a haughty look and did not reply, arranging her pillows and duvet around herself, and promptly falling back asleep before they'd even gotten to the highway. Quentin was extremely pleased when she slept through the first 5 hours of the trip, and when his cell phone rang around noon, he turned it off and threw it in the back seat. Those fuckers can leave me the hell alone, he thought irritably. Jamie and Rosie are adults. Tim has his damn godfather, the great and mighty wizard who never has time to come visit me to look out for his ass, and the rest of the house can implode for all I care.
Solange, he hissed. Wake up. Do you want to have lunch?
I don't know,
she said fretfully. If you say those three words again, I'll choke you. Apparently unaware of this hostile inner monologue, Solange yawned and sat up, politely inquiring about how things were going at the business. Quentin gave a rather neutral reply and asked about her French poetry translations, and Solange announced she never should have done it since no one had the slightest interest in publishing it.
I guess it wasn't such a great idea,
she sighed gloomily as she gazed out the window at the pelting sleet.
She said you were in a better mood, Quentin replied impatiently. What happened to that?
I don't know, she said crossly. I'm trying to make conversation with you.
She has to try and make conversation with me? What the fuck kind of marriage is this? And if she says, I don't know, one more time, I'll get out of the car and walk home. Solange suddenly craned her head towards the back seat.
Shh, she announced dramatically. Did you hear that?
Hear what?
Came a growl from the rear.
What was that?
Solange squealed.
I don't know,
Quentin replied with a nasty sort of smirk. The voice grunted again, and several of Solange's tote bags toppled to the floor. Solange let out a shriek, and Quentin slammed on the brakes.
If that is Kenny, he said through gritted teeth, I will kill him this time.
If that's Kenny, I'll help you kill him, Solange yelped. He's scaring me to death. Kenny! Kenny, is that you?
She snatched up her umbrella and began poking at the items in the back seat. And there was a great bellowing sound as everything flew up in the air at once.
Oh, Lord! Bawled a loud voice as Lucretia's head and shoulders popped into view. Oh, Lord, where's I at?
Solange started giggling. Shit. Quentin smiled and shook his head. Shit.
Lucretia! Solange chortled delightedly. How on earth did you end up back there?
How the hell did you fit back there? Quentin thought to himself.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Lucretia shrieked with a panicked expression.
Oh, no, this is awful. Here I done gotten your car with you, and you are going on your trip today.
You're not going on the trip, Quentin told her sternly. We are on the trip. Almost to Würzburg.
Lucretia's mouth dropped open.
Germany? Germany, you saying we in Germany?
She screeched and stared avidly out the window.
Well, I ain't never been to no other country except England and the States. Look at that, German trees, German cars. There's some German peoples out there. I bet they're talking in German.
Solange and Quentin exchanged a smile.
Lucretia, Quentin said mildly, I thought you've only been to England and the States. You have 5 weeks vacation a year. Don't tell me you can't afford to go anywhere.
Well, Lucretia blushed. I can't. But that ain't your fault, Mr. Quiller. You pays me awful good, awful good. It's just my auntie and uncle and my sister can't work neither because she done had the strokes. And all three of them, they medicines cost me $1,600 a month.
And my sister husband can't find no job. There ain't no jobs in the States, she declared ominously. Especially if you black and live in Alabama. Don't nobody care if we had that zebra president, Obama, Hama, Mama. He ain't done me no good. And I got to go home on my vacation because my sister, she need to break from taking care of Auntie Ebony and Uncle Cotton.
Quentin barely managed to keep the car on the road after this statement, and Lucretia frowned when he and Solange burst out laughing.
Sorry, he told her quickly. We're all laughing about your family troubles, and we'll help you out. It's about Auntie Ebony and Uncle Cotton.
Solange let out a great scream of laughter, and her eyes flashed impishly.
Oh, wait till we tell Elizabeth and Remus's story, she screeched.
She is awfully cute, Quentin thought grudgingly. She is damn cute.
Well, ain't nothing funny about that, Lucretia grumbled. That's their names. I want to know how I got in this car.
She glared at Quentin accusingly in the dashboard mirror.
Well, I didn't put you there, he replied cheerfully. Hell, I'd break my damn neck.
What were you doing last night, Lucretia?
Solange giggled.
None of this is funny, she muttered dourly. I was reading that Bible with Kenny, and then somebody bring me some tea, and I drank, and I get real tired. That's all I remember.
That fucker drugged your drink, Quentin snapped.
What? Lucretia screamed. What? You think he done drugged me up? Oh, Lord, I bet he done had his way with me. I bet he had them nasty crack-ass freckly hands all over my bosoms, and Lord only know what else.
Now we don't know that, Quentin said sternly as Solange buried her face in her hands and giggled frantically.
We're talking about Kenny here. He couldn't even pick you up. That was a friend. He can levitate things, she hollered furiously. It's cause that easy spell, and I bet Kenny drugged me up and then he think I'm bad, so he try to hide my body in his car.
It's okay, Lucretia, Solange told her happily. You said you've never been out of the country. You'll love going on this trip with us.
Quentin started to open his mouth and then shut it.
Oh, I can stay with you all,
Lucretia shrieked ecstatically.
Even if that will be the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my whole life.
Sure you can, they blurted out in unison, and Lucretia nodded knowingly.
I see how it be then, she said complacently. You two don't mind me here, because you ain't been getting along,
she announced tactlessly, but neither of them disagreed with her. Hilbert E. Grindelwald, the perennially foul-tempered warlock at the security desk, was not having a good day. He never had a good day, actually. His general disposition making this quite impossible. But today had been especially tiresome. The morning had begun with one of the security trolls grunting desperately while clutching at its stomach and pointing frantically towards the departure areas.
You're staying right where you are, Hilbert had snapped unkindly. Slackers! That's what you trolls are! Slackers!
The troll's response to this was to squat down and emit a horrific groan, followed by a blast of steaming green poo that mounted up into a rancid 12-foot pile of feces directly in front of the security desk. Exactly 30 seconds later, the minister himself had walked by, giving Hilbert a thoroughly disgusted and positively threatening look. As if it were my fault, Hilbert thought sulkily. After that, the wand identifier had gone on the fritz, incorrectly identifying an old woman's wand as belonging to Lord Voldemort and setting off a general panic. George Weasley had given Hilbert a rude hand gesture rather than his wand, resulting in much derisive laughter from the crowd. And now, possibly the worst of all, Antonin Grinlittle was mincing his way towards the table in the food court.
Good day, Hilbert,
Tony declared enthusiastically as he sashayed over to the empty chair and sat himself with a flourish, crossing one yellow and orange silk striped trousered leg across the other.
How are we?
Hilbert did not respond.
As charming as always, I see, Tony enthused. Marvelous. I couldn't have been more thrilled myself when I spotted you at the only open table.
Maybe if I don't say anything, Hilbert thought angrily, he'll go away.
Bat got your tongue?
Tony asked drolly and smiled at his own joke.
And they say we vampires are a dull lot.
Perhaps you're a vampire, he murmured solicitously. You do seem a bit pale.
Not to worry, I'll never tell.
I'm not a vampire, Hilbert shouted wrathfully and jumped to his feet. Don't you dare start any rumors!
My, Hilbert, what a fuss!
Tony sighed and waved his hands dismissively. I do apologize.
Come up to my department and I'll show you my new magical pygmy pigs. Captain Lupin ordered them. I love them, he said ardently. They're only 10 inches high, fully grown, and they speak. But I cannot deliver them until next week, he whispered excitedly. He says it will take him that long to convince his wife to let him have them, he trilled delightedly.
Halbert grumbled, apparently forgetting he wasn't speaking to Tony.
That muggle wife of Scott leads him around by the tail. Dreadful hag of a woman, he frowned. Started a riot at my desk and her out in public about to give birth. Scandalous. No breathing.
I am terribly fond of Mrs. Lupin, Tony responded silkily. She does love her colored cats. She always stops by when she's here to ask my advice about her red cat. We've almost got it trained, he announced breathlessly. And she's dreadfully afraid of vampires, you know, he added soberly. But she said she found me so kind and non-threatening that... His voice broke as tears threatened in his eyes. She believes I'm helping her to overcome her fears, he choked out and blew his nose loudly into the garish magenta handkerchief. No one has ever told me anything like that before. They only tell me I frighten them, he shuddered. When she told me that, I was extremely touched, simply overcome, and then she let me hold the new baby. She did. She did. The baby is simply gorgeous. I adore Elizabeth Lupin, he pronounced melodramatically. I absolutely adore her. And if you say another word against her, I shall bite you, he asserted decisively and picked up his fork. Did you hear that? Halbert roared to the next table where Percy Weasley and two extremely ugly witches sat in sullen silence.
He just threatened me. You heard him. I want to file charges.
You won't file charges every other day, Percy replied haughtily. It's a waste of the Ministry's time and money. This fellow from the MLE says they've got to file for all your complaints, you know. It's a waste, Cam, with your name on it, he added, and Tony smiled.
Percy! Percy has made a joke! He called out loudly. Percy Weasley! Let's hear it now, people! Some positive reinforcement, please!
A great deal of clapping ensued, and Percy turned red with pleasure and stood to take a bow.
I'm sure you didn't know it was funny, Tony said kindly, but the effort was there, just the same. And as far as you, Halbert, he added threateningly, I will call you out. That is quite legal, he stated adamantly. I shall kill you, and everyone will be most grateful. Good day.
Lucretia's eyes appeared perilously close to popping out of her head as they parked the car at an auto stop and strolled across the Alte Mainbrück, Würzburg's old main bridge built in 1473. The bridge, which was lined on both sides with huge statues of saints and other famous figures, presented the three with a delightful view of Würzburg, a beautiful old Baroque village surrounded by forested hills, dotted with vineyards and clustered with brightly painted Bavarian cottages, winding cobblestone streets, ancient stone walls, and medieval churches.
Oh, oh, Lucretia gasped and clutched her chest. "'Tis a wonderful day. A wonderful day!
It's like going back in time, Solange yelled excitedly and clapped her hands.
Quentin couldn't resist smiling at them. The sleet had stopped, and the sun burst out from behind the grassy hills, puffy white clouds scuttling across the sky and creating an unseasonably pleasant afternoon for the travelers and the surrounding crowd on the bridge. There were peasants carrying buckets and pulling carts, stout housewives in kerchiefs, cotton dresses, and boots loaded with bags of produce, an occasional wide-eyed tourist, men in business suits with bushy mustaches and thick wooden pipes arguing loudly, and a stray goat with a triangular metal bell around its neck that clanged as it brayed loudly. The mood was ebullient as the passersby exchanged enthusiastic greetings with one another, waved, and offered friendly nods to the visitors. Once inside the city proper, they entered the market square, the center of local activity, and paused to admire the Marienkapelle, a famous Gothic church of impressive height, its rich red spires and pointed arches glittering in the sun.
Dasan say this a Gothic church,
Lucretia announced with a frown.
That's right, Quentin said agreeably. Classic example.
I wouldn't know, Lucretia responded gloomily. I don't know what would make a church Gothic. I ain't got no culture. I grew up on a pig farm in Alabama. I spent my whole life in a kitchen or in a pigsty. I wish I could learn about art and architecture and fancy clothes before I dies, she finished dourly.
You should go on an educational tour, Lucretia, Solange put in consolingly. You know, like an architectural tour, Renaissance tour, or something like that. Then you could learn things while you're going places.
Lucretia did not appear excited by this advice.
That ain't never going to happen, she sighed. My sister watch in Ebony and Uncle Cotton all year long. I got to give her a break when I has vacation time.
They made their way down the broad cobblestone street of the square, pausing by a small market stall for some hot spiced glühwein and vinegar sausages, and stopped in front of a group of men in lederhosen doing a traditional Bavarian dance. Lucretia started smiling.
"That's okay, though," she said contentedly. "I gots to go on this vacation, and I gots to get some books out of the library. Person need to be happy with what they got. If they can't do that, they ain't never going to be happy at all."
"Ouch," Quentin thought to himself, although he knew the remark wasn't directed at him. Solange tugged at his sleeve and pointed out a young blonde boy, no older than 5, who pulled out a flute and began playing a lively tune, while a larger version of himself, apparently his brother, produced a small drum, and an elderly man beside them started yodeling enthusiastically while accompanying himself with a brightly painted accordion.
"This is great!" Solange squealed and started clapping along with the crowd,
and several young girls began to giggle and dance. Quentin gave Lucretia a thoughtful look.
"You bring Auntie Ebony and Uncle Cotton to live with us," he told her sternly. "Then you won't have to pay for their upkeep, and I won't have to lay off some of the servants I don't really need anymore. And I can make a new seating chart," he added to himself.
"That lazy maid Elizabeth can take care of Auntie Ebony," Solange hooted gleefully. "She never did anything. Elizabeth used to pick up after her."
"Albert's getting too old to keep up a 5-kilometer garden," Quentin mused. "He can look after Uncle Cotton."
"It'll help people keep their jobs, Lucretia, and your aunt and uncle can get their medicines free, and you'll have extra money every month and can go on real vacations,"
Solange told Lucretia encouragingly, as a myriad of emotions crossed her broad face.
"Oh, Mr. Quilla, that's so nice of you," she shrilled suddenly, apparently having made up her mind to accept this offer. You're the bestest person in the whole world. With my extra money, I'm going to get me that big, vivid Jesus picture I've been wanting, and then them massy furry lampshades for my sitting room, and go on one of them education tours. Maybe save up for another coat that beautiful mink I got. And maybe I guess you one of them minks, Miss Solange,"
she proclaimed generously, and Solange gave Quentin a frightened look. The crowd began singing along with the dancers and the amateur musicians to what was apparently an old Bavarian folk tune. And now and then someone would pause to bite into a giant pretzel, or tear off a piece of dark bread, which they dipped into a communal pot of mustard balanced on an old stone fountain. Everyone held enormous steins of beer in their hands, and no one, Quentin observed, appeared to care that it was 3 p.m. on a Thursday. When the dancing concluded, they strolled past more outdoor marketplaces, while a beatifically smiling Lucretia passed around salami rolls, pretzels, bratwurst, a loaf of rye bread, and a large tin of spiced mustard, goods she had obtained by some mysterious means she would not discuss.
"Look at this place!" Solange gushed ecstatically as they hurried to the ancient walled enclosure of the Fortress Marienburg,
a medieval ring wall which contained several churches and small castles close to 1,000 years old.
"I love Kenny," Lucretia shouted out blissfully. "I love him. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here now."
"Henry will be happy to hear that," Quentin remarked pleasantly. "I'll bet he can move Kenny's shit into your quarters in 20 minutes.
10, Solange said knowingly. "Probably less."
"I don't love him that much," Lucretia replied hastily.
After the fortress, they chatted cheerfully on their way back across the bridge, finishing their snacks and admiring the view, while Quentin informed Lucretia they were going to tour the Palace Residence, which he promised would be the highlight of the day.
"This palace was inspired by the Palace of Versailles,"
Solange called out as they pulled up to the massive 3-winged fortress-like building.
"It's one of the most beautiful palaces in the world. The Prince Bishops of Würzburg built it from 1720 to 1744, and they didn't spare any expense. They brought over famous Venetian painter Giovanni Battista Tiepolo to paint the frescoes on the ceilings and the walls. And they're the largest frescoes in the world and the most gorgeous,"
she finished breathlessly, and leapt out of the car so quickly she nearly fell off her 4-inch heeled Louis Vuitton gold sequined embroidered shimmery ankle boots. Lupin awoke face down in a pool of his own blood, a crushing weight of rock covering his entire body. "This is not good," he thought wryly, and tried to take a breath, which only succeeded in filling his lungs with blood and dust and sent him into a violent paroxysm of coughing. The weight of the rocks began to shift as someone tossed them to the side.
"What do you think you are doing?" he heard Radu say sharply. "Get yourself out from under those rocks and stop that coughing. It is extremely irritating. I cannot endure it."
"Oh my God, that fucker's still alive. Put the rocks back on and let me die."
"You have ripped your shoulder open," Radu announced accusingly, and examined him with a censorious eye. "It is torn right down to the bone."
Episcopi sanguineo, he said crossly.
Lupin was astonished when the horrific gaping wound disappeared completely.
Thanks, he croaked out. Damn, you're good.
You would be particularly certain of that,
Radu replied smugly as he perched himself on a nearby pile of rock and folded his hands in a poised manner over his elegantly crossed legs.
Should you let me entertain you for a few hours?
He drawled out meaningfully.
Sod off,
Lupin said in a strangled voice and spat out some dust and blood on the ground.
You'll kill me, you'll fuck me.
Both, I believe,
Radu responded indifferently.
Although you are most unattractive when you're carrying on like that,
he added as Lupin fell into another paroxysm of violent coughing. Lupin sat up gingerly and examined the torn shreds of his shirt and ripped trousers, which exposed a dozen other wounds and an innumerable amount of cuts, scratches, and abrasions. Radu, whose black velvet breeches, impeccably tailored long lavender silk shirt, and knee-high leather boots were in perfect condition, appeared completely unscathed, although some of his waist-length hair had come loose from the square pendant of amethyst at the back of his neck, giving him an uncharacteristically disheveled appearance. Lupin gave him an irritated look.
How in the hell did you manage not to get hurt?
I morphed into my bat form as the floor collapsed,
Radu responded smugly,
and flew just below the falling rock. It is very fortunate for you that I am so quick-thinking. That rock could have crushed my brain and killed me, and then you would have drowned in your own blood,
he added in a pleased voice.
Well, that's how I've always wanted to go, Lupin replied acerbically. Did you rip up my clothes, your fangs?
You should only hope,
Radu replied with an enigmatic expression.
Now, I have tried to operate out of here. It cannot be done. Apparently, we are more than 1,000 feet beneath rock.
Aguamenti,
he handed Lupin a cup of water.
Drink,
he said impatiently.
And if you cough again, I will strike you.
Thanks,
Lupin replied gloomily.
You're far too kind. What do you think we are?
At the bottom of my castle, I believe, Radu intoned coldly, in the pitiful remains of my dungeons. I'm having great trouble hiring anyone to rebuild them.
He gave Lupin a scathing look.
For some unfathomable reason, the villagers believe they are haunted by a fire-breathing werewolf.
And do not think I will not send your minister a financial statement of the damages.
Don't do that, Lupin said hastily. Those people will kill me. My paycheck's always getting docked something,
he added gloomily.
Anyway, I'll fix it for you. Reparo!
He gave Radu a triumphant look as the dungeons reappeared in their exact previous state, but his expression altered considerably when he noticed they were now sitting in a 15-by-15-foot cell behind massive iron bars. Radu jumped to his feet.
What have you done? He shouted incredulously.
I've repaired them for you,
Lupin replied solemnly.
You could at least say thank you.
We are locked in these dungeons,
Radu screamed wrathfully and stormed around the cell at least 10 times.
They're impenetrable. There is no password.
There's got to be a key then,
Lupin said stubbornly.
There's always a key. Who's got it?
For a moment, Radu could not even speak.
The chief jailer is in possession of the key,
he yelled wildly.
And can you possibly surmise where the chief jailer is?
Right, Lupin mumbled. I suppose I killed him when I busted out Lupescu. It's kind of ironic, though, isn't it?
Radu snatched up a loose piece of rock and flung it at him, and Lupin ducked out of the way.
Sorry,
he muttered apologetically.
He tried to kill me first.
This is unbelievable, Radu shouted with a maniacal expression. I am locked up in my own dungeons. I am buried under a mile of rock and locked up in my own dungeons with the one person in the world I absolutely cannot tolerate.
He didn't have a great bloody tantrum,
Lupin told him resentfully.
Said I was sorry.
Radu turned his back and kicked the stone wall.
Here I thought you were such a self-contained fellow,
Lupin mused.
I've been trapped 100 times. There's always a way out. I don't suppose you still got your wand?
Radu did not reply.
Yeah, me neither,
he said dolefully.
How long will it take them to dig us out?
Weeks, Radu snarled. They cannot blast through this rock or it will fall in on us. They will have to dig us out with pickaxes like muggles, he shouted.
Okay, Lupin retorted impatiently. Will you please calm down? We find a way out before then. In the meantime, we'll need provisions,
he added thoughtfully.
I can make chocolate and fire whiskey.
Wonderful, Radu hissed. We will be drunk and sick on chocolate when we die.
And we need to send a rescue message. I can't send a note for too deep to apparate. What's that bell for?
He pointed to a cracked iron bell with a frayed yellow rope that hung listlessly near one of the bars.
Alarm, his cellmate replied shortly, and Lupin yanked on the rope. Good, Radu spat out. Good, pull it again. Now the chief jailer, who is dead, will know that we are in trouble and climb up from his grave to rescue us.
You needn't be so negative, Lupin told him calmly.
Got to look at this sort of thing as an exercise in problem solving, he added in his professor's voice.
I look at it as an exercise in patience, Radu thought furiously. Before I go for your throat, I will kill you, fuck you, and drink your blood. He started smiling in a self-satisfied manner.
Don't you dare look at me like that,
Lupin snarled and stalked up into his face.
You aren't doing anything to me. I'll kick your pampered ass into next week, and when it's full moon, I'll kill you. And then I'll eat you, he added nastily. I'm sure I'll be starved by then.
Radu let out an outraged yell.
Do not attempt to read my mind! You cannot possibly penetrate my thoughts. They are far superior to your own, he hissed.
I wasn't trying to read your bloody mind, Lupin replied heatedly. I wouldn't want to. But I can't help if you're thinking so loudly you're practically shouting at me.
Radu did not respond to this, and Lupin had this distinct impression he was embarrassed.
Look, he said apologetically, don't worry about it. If you're around anyone who's a decent legilimens and you're thinking something very intently, don't look them in the eye. That's what gave you away.
I care nothing for your advice, Ryder replied spitefully. Do not speak to me.
It doesn't bother me if you're thinking about killing me and drinking my blood, Lupin responded reassuringly. I am a werewolf, you know. I could have done without the other bit, he added with a disgusted face. Especially if you're doing it to somebody who's dead. That's just disgusting.
He waved up some chocolate and fire whiskey onto a large flat rock, and gave the corner of the cell a glance, which produced a cheery fireplace.
I am not a necrophiliac, Roddy replied irritably. Someone you have killed moments ago is scarcely dead. They're still warm.
Oh, you've a point there, Lupin said agreeably. Here, have some chocolate. You'll feel better.
I am not one of the children on the train, Roddy responded irately, and Lupin stifled a laugh.
Have you been rereading the books, Liviu?
It is none of your concern, he responded haughtily. Pour me a drink.
Lupin, who knew Radu still felt quite humiliated, poured him a goblet of fire whiskey without comment.
Sorry I can't make any chairs, he shrugged. There are quite a few things I can conjure up without my wand, but furniture isn't one of them.
Furniture is very basic,
Radu responded derisively and pointed at the stone floor, where an impressively opulent Turkish sofa carved in beechwood and gilded in gold appeared, three overstuffed red and gold tasseled pillows materializing on top of the rich red velvet fabric. He yawned lazily and stretched himself out on the couch, arranging the pillows beneath his head with a great theatrical display of pleasure.
This couch is exceptionally comfortable, he purred in a blissfully satiated voice. It is utterly divine. I do not believe I have reclined on anything so incredibly satisfying in my entire life.
Lupin gave him a revolted look.
Who's the drama queen now? He said rudely. Make me a sofa, will you?
I shall make you a chair, Radu announced magnanimously. A very small chair, on which, he added generously, I shall grant you the privilege of sitting.
He snapped his fingers and produced a tiny straight-backed rickety wooden chair with a broken leg.
You grant me the privilege of sitting, Lupin spat out venomously, on that sodding piece of shit where you're sprawled out on your velvet chariot. You make me a bloody sofa, he snarled.
I will not, Radu responded loftily and chewed thoughtfully on a piece of chocolate. I find your manner of address appallingly disrespectful. I do not know how I have borne it so long. It is testimony to the generosity of my nature that I speak to you at all.
He let out a satisfied sigh and arranged the pillows beneath his head again.
Make me a damn sofa! Lupin yelled violently. I'll shove your spoiled ass right into that fireplace and don't think I won't. Maybe you won't die, but you'll be one charred up motherfucker who's not quite so pretty in his silks and satin.
He finished mockingly. The two of them exchanged murderous looks.
I'm waiting, Lupin said ominously. I'm waiting for my sofa.
Radu flung his hand out, and a tattered old sofa with sagging springs and scratchy upholstery appeared, and Lupin was unsurprised when he found it exactly 2 inches short for him to lie down on comfortably.
Thanks, he told Radu agreeably. This is excellent. It's exactly like the sofa in the Shrieking Shack. It'll remind me of my Marauder days.
Radu pretended he hadn't heard this.
"Now, I will make you some Transylvanian fire whiskey, and we will drink that," he announced authoritatively. "It is far superior to your wretched British version."
"Fine," Lupin replied genially. "Just don't get near my side of the cell."
"We will draw a line," Radu told him resolutely, "and divide it in half, and I do not wish to come to your side of the cell. I will never come near your side of the cell. You could not possibly beg me to come to your side of the cell."
"Of course I could," Lupin responded with a smirk.
"But I won't, so don't get your hopes up." "I would not touch you if you were the last man on earth," Radu hissed malevolently. "I absolutely loathe and utterly despise you."
"I'm awfully glad to hear it," Lupin replied pleasantly. "I feel exactly the same way. It's good to know we're in agreement about something."
"This a wonderful, wonderful day," Lucretia repeated ecstatically as they approached the entranceway to the Palace residence. "It sure is."
"It's certainly getting better," Quentin thought to himself, as he glanced down at Solange's flared, low-rise, form-fitting cream-colored velvet pants and low-cut dark rose silk bustier, barely covered by a long, loose-fitting open-lace cardigan trimmed with large round buttons of topaz. While the tour guide droned on endlessly about the history of the palace, Quentin deliberated on whether Solange might be wearing a thong, what said thong might look like, if it would show when she bent over, and, after deciding it definitely would, how he could subtly drop something on the floor.
"What are you thinking about?"
Solange asked him archly. "Thongs," he blurted out, and she giggled.
"What about them?"
she said coyly. "Well," he replied after a moment's quick thinking, "Remus showed up in my office one day to inform me Elizabeth was wearing those muggle blue jeans with something called a thong, and that he bloody well loved that thong."
"I got me a whole drawer full of thongs," Lucretia announced enthusiastically, and Quentin winced. "Full of thongs. My favorite, the leopard print one. Mm-hmm. That sure look good on my big bootylicious curves."
"Elizabeth has a whole drawer full of thongs now, too," Solange announced knowingly. "You wouldn't believe it."
"You have to fill me in on all the gossip I've missed," Quentin replied affably. "You know, during the 6 months I was being an ass." As he'd expected, Solange was delighted with this request.
"You are being very sweet," she told him approvingly. "I can tell you lots of good stories. Lots and lots," she squealed jubilantly.
"Tell me something that will embarrass him," Quentin replied with a smirk, and Solange clutched his arm in a conspiratorial manner.
"Oh, I'll tell you," she yelped gleefully. "I know all the gossip about him. Elizabeth says he's perverted," she hissed happily. "She's always telling me stuff he wants her to do and that she thinks is really bad."
"Don't tell me about that," Quentin responded hastily.
"I wants to hear," Lucretia chimed in stubbornly.
"Some of it is kind of weird," Solange continued undeterred. "But some of it's just because Elizabeth's being stupid. She won't let him go down on her,"
she burst out excitedly as several people backed away from them.
"Because she thinks that twat's are gross."
"Oh my God," Quentin thought incredulously. "Why in the hell did I open my mouth?"
"That's too bad," Lucretia clucked and shook her head solemnly. "Solange, please be quiet," Quentin whispered furiously.
"He followed her around the house all day once, begging her to let him do it,"
Solange hollered in response, and Lucretia chortled loudly.
"I'm going to have a talk with her," Lucretia nodded determinedly. "Ain't nothing wrong with this to Miss Kitty."
"Will you two change the damn subject?" Quentin hissed desperately.
"But what the hell is Miss Kitty?" "It's what Mother calls a twat," Solange replied with satisfaction. "When we'd have our bath, she'd yell up the stairs, 'Don't forget to wash Miss Kitty! I won't have any daughters of mine smelling like a fish market!'"
"We will begin the tour," the guide announced quickly, and the group headed en masse towards the grand staircase.
"I don't know why he cares, though. Should give him a blowjob whenever he wants," Solange sang out cheerfully. "Don't you think he should just be happy with that?"
she demanded and looked expectantly up at Quentin. Quentin opened his mouth, but found he could not speak.
"Yes'm, he ought to be happy with that," Lucretia replied agreeably. "Do she swallow?"
"Oh, for God's sake, shut up," Quentin shouted wildly. "Don't say another damn word." Solange and Lucretia both gave him reproachful looks.
"You not call me Mr. Chicky?" an Asian man behind them called out suddenly. "'Tis not political correct."
"Who gives a rat's arse?" an Irishman bellowed back. "Should have been looking at me wife's titties."
"I'm not looking at white titty."
Can no one behave appropriately in public anymore? Quentin thought apparently. Apparently, they could not.
"He ain't looking at her titties," Lucretia told the scowling red-headed fellow. "If he wanted to look at titties, he'd be looking at mine. My titty way bigger than hers. Mm-hmm. And my titty's looking good in this tight sweater."
"Here we have the grand staircase," the tour guide bellowed hastily, and the group hurried to the top of the winding staircase, where the world's largest fresco was emblazoned across the dome of the vestibule.
"Oh, oh, my poor old sweet dead granny," Lucretia screeched appreciatively. "I done died and gone to heaven."
"This is incredible," Solange squealed and actually leapt up and down. "It's so beautiful. I can't believe it."
"It was pretty damn impressive," Quentin agreed.
"Mr. Quilla," Lucretia said breathlessly. "I go on a faint. You be careful when you catch me. I don't look like it, but I weigh 260 pounds.
Solange chortled, and Quentin leaned over to whisper in her ear.
"She weighs 260, he muttered. "I'm 5'4". If she starts falling, I'll jump out of the way faster than that bloody werewolf could."
"Don't be bad,"
Solange responded sternly, but her eyes were dancing. "I love you," he thought suddenly, and looked away. And Solange, who had caught a brief glimpse of his expression, found herself wishing he would look back. "What am I supposed to do now?" she thought forlornly. "Sometimes I think I love him, and sometimes I can't stand him. And I know we'd be really happy for a while, until I get on his nerves and he starts yelling at me to quit bothering him, and then I'll get depressed again, and we'll fight all the time." The crowd oohed and aahed loudly at the intricately detailed rocaille of the white room, and Solange told herself to focus on the splendor of the north and south wing apartments, which was rather easily done, as each dazzling room was more sumptuously decorated than its predecessor. Even the Hofkirche, the church within the palace, was simply stunning, she thought. With its textbook Baroque interior lavishly decorated with paintings, detailed sculptures, exquisite stucco ornaments, and dazzling hand-painted marble columns. Quentin and Solange sat down in a pew to wait for Lucretia, who had gone off to the bathroom for what Quentin was sure was the 30th time that day. And Solange was pleased when Quentin started waxing artistic about the chapel.
"Balthasar Neumann, he was the chief architect for this palace, developed his own kind of refined brand of Baroque architecture," he told Solange cheerfully. "He wanted to make this fusion of Austrian, Bohemian, Italian, and French elements. You see here how he's used mirrors and hidden windows to bring in light and create symmetry."
"I like it when you talk about art,"
Solange told him demurely.
"Good," he replied willingly. "I'll talk about it more then. What do you want to hear?"
"Anything, really,"
she hesitated.
"I like to hear about it anyway, but I like to watch you talk about it, too,"
she said sincerely.
"Your eyes light up, and, well, you can tell it's your passion."
"One of them," he replied seriously and looked at her intently.
Solange felt her breath catch in her throat, as if she had suddenly forgotten how to swallow, and watched the gold light of the room reflect off the blackness of his eyes. It was strange, she thought, how black eyes could have different shades within them, or maybe it was more like different textures, a liquid pool of ink, than a rough charcoal. It was his eyes, she thought, that would be her undoing, his intense and enigmatic eyes, a puzzle she wanted to solve. Without thinking, she reached out and ran her hand through the dark waves of hair around the back of his neck, and her heart started pounding as she relished in his quick intake of breath.
"Ooh-wee," Lucretia sang out as she plopped herself down between them. "Let's go to that wine-making place so's we can get to dinner. I'm hungry."
"Yes, I sure is." Quentin closed his eyes.
"Sure," he said resignedly.
After touring the Burgerspittel, the area's largest wine producer, with its beautiful cellars lined with hand-carved wooden barrels dating back to the 1300s, the travelers chose the Nikolshof for dinner, deciding they preferred a small restaurant with authentic Bavarian flavor and charm to a larger and more cosmopolitan one.
"Oh, look at this food," Lucretia hummed delightedly as she pawed through her menu. "Mm-hmm. And I ain't got to make none of it, neither. What you gonna have, Miss Solange?"
Solange replied happily. "Maybe this during a closer. That's dumplings with pan-fried toast bread inside,"
she recited to Quentin.
"Or maybe this during a roast brattle, pork neck steak covered in onions they marinate in beer and mustard."
"Pick out something I like," Quentin told Lucretia generously, and she beamed proudly at the suggestion.
"I think you might like,"
Solange began.
"I'm the cook here," Lucretia told her threateningly. "You mind your manners, missy."
Solange put her napkin over her mouth and giggled helplessly.
"Now, I tells you anything you need to know about German food, Miss Aquila."
"I done studied it,"
Lucretia announced firmly.
"Sure," Quentin agreed amiably as a tall and jovial fellow filled their wine glasses.
"Breakfast called fresh duck," Lucretia continued. "Usually this has bread rolls with jam or honey and eggs, and they coffee real strong. And for breakfast they has the deli meats too, like salami or salted meats, and even meat-based spread like Leberwurst, that liver sausage."
That's a pretty heavy breakfast, Solange commented, and Lucretia frowned at her. I done told you, she said ominously. Mr. Quill and I's talking. Does I have to put you out in the car?
Apparently, when we take Lucretia out to eat, Quentin muttered to Solange, who was chortling into her napkin again, you become 6 years old. See that you don't forget. And quit interrupting the grown-ups.
The waitress, a cheery young pigtailed blonde named Gretel, appeared in her traditional Bavarian dirndl, complete with a polished white, puffy-sleeved blouse, an embroidered dark red velvet bodice, a cream-and-rose patterned apron topping a moss-green ruffled skirt, textured hose, and black leather clogs.
"Have you decided?"
she inquired politely, but Lucretia just kept right on talking.
The main meal, Mr. Quilla, usually lunch, a mittagessen. A big meal had 2 to 7 courses, an appetizer, soup, a main course with 1 or 2 raw cooked side dishes, and after meal treats. They call them after dinner treats, Nachspeise. Mm-hmm, and everybody had coffee and cake ready at their house all the time in case they had some guests.
The waitress gave Quentin a pleading look.
Oh, that's very interesting, he told Lucretia gravely. We mustn't hold this girl up. Let's order.
All right, Lucretia said happily, the lure of eating the food apparently overwhelming her desire to talk about it.
I want this Spanferkel, that spit-roasted baby pig, and some Schwabische Kaschbätzle, them flour dumplings topped with cheese and butter, and them finger sausages, roast bratwurst, and this gherkin shallot, the cucumber salad, for my appetizer, and some of that Keraton M beer, that's Kerosene beer.
Not hungry, are you? Quentin asked her dispassionately.
I'll have the...
Solange began. I'm an order for Mr. Quilla, Lucretia informed her loudly. You wait your turn, missy. Now, Mr. Quilla gonna have the goulash super, that goulash soup, for his soup, and kartoffel klosser, them potato dumplings, Mr. Quilla, and knockwurst with sauerkraut, and the roulade, and some New Jaws pretzel, them soft pretzels, Mr. Quilla, and that roast pork loin and beer sauce, and for dessert, that Veschgen Duchy, that Bavarian plum cake. Mm-hmm. And if you can't finish, Mr. Quilla, she told him demurely as she folded up the menu, I'll finish your leftover for you.
Yes, I will.
Thank you, Quentin told her soberly and winked at Solange.
May I have a glass of wine?
Solange asked Lucretia innocently, and they made a horrible face at her when she glanced down at her menu.
Well, I guess one glass okay,
Lucretia replied grudgingly.
I wish Elizabeth was here,
Solange hissed to Quentin.
She does this to her, too, whenever we go out. As soon as we leave the house, we're little kids. She took her to the mall once to shop for an Easter dress, and she made us go back and put on gloves. Gloves! We had to borrow them from Mother. And hats,
she shuddered.
You speak up, Lucretia told her sternly. Don't be whispering over there. They're rude.
Fine, Solange replied sweetly. Then, when we got to the mall, Lucretia kept bossing us so much we couldn't stop laughing, and so she separated us. She made Elizabeth wait on a bench outside the store.
That's right, Lucretia nodded unrepentantly. If you can't get girls to behave, you separate them. Then they straighten up, she told Quentin knowingly.
How the hell do you do this? Quentin said incredulously. I can't even make Solange quit yelling embarrassing shit in public. And I'd like to see that bloody werewolf make Elizabeth sit on a bench outside a store.
She'd smack him, Solange said happily.
He'd like it, Quentin rejoined disgustedly.
It's cause I done things with them, Lucretia said wisely. I did. I read them stories and played with them, and I got to go to Miss Elizabeth Penny recitables. Yes, I sure did. And I took them shopping into the park, cause you knows Miss Caroline didn't take them nowhere, she scowled. She home watching her stories, out with her girlfriend, or playing bridge, or going to parties. And if they was upset, they come tell me about it. Not Miss Caroline, no sir. Me,
Lucretia stressed proudly.
Well, who wants to talk to Mother if they were upset?
Solange said in a practical voice.
You only do it once, I'll tell you that. One time, Elizabeth was bawling at dinner, and she said, this boy I like dumped me for somebody else. And Mother told her, well, maybe she was prettier than you, or smarter, or maybe she had a better personality and went to parties with other girls, instead of staying home reading books and banging on that piano.
Quentin winced. It sounds to me, he told Lucretia thoughtfully. You were more of a mother to them than Caroline was.
Oh, Lord! Lucretia wailed and began blubbering into a large checkered handkerchief. That's just the nicest thing anybody ever said to me. I got to go to the bathroom!
She waddled off, sobbing. Why is it that I can say the nicest thing to Lucretia? Quentin mused when she was gone. And I always get it wrong with you.
It isn't what you say, Solange replied considerately. It's what you do.
Both of them were quiet for a moment. I keep thinking the answer's right there in front of my face, Quentin said soberly, and I'm missing it.
The answer?
Solange queried in a perplexed tone. Why I keep fucking this up, he replied firmly, and what I need to do to fix it and keep it fixed.
I think you just get tired of me after a while,
Solange said forlornly. No, it isn't that, he told her quietly. It's never been that. She leaned towards him and kissed him on the cheek, and he caught her chin in his hand and turned her lips up towards his, trying to put every feeling he had for her in the kiss that followed. A warning and an apology, a plea for forgiveness, a substitute for all the words he couldn't say, and all the things he didn't understand. Her fingers tightened around his, and she smiled with a hint of sadness in her eyes.
Oh, I feel better, Lucrece announced blissfully as she plopped back down in her seat.
Uh-huh, I does. There was some lady next to me. She was making the most disgusting noises, she frowned. I'm talking disgusting. Sound like a whole herd of animals up in their guts and they trying to blast a way out. And the smell was like, Lucretia, stop,
Solange shrieked, and both she and Quentin broke out laughing. I can't take you to anywhere, he told them sternly. You're the two most embarrassing women on the planet.
Well,
Solange said archly,
are you taking us back home then?
No, he replied slyly. You know we've got to stick to the itinerary. While they were driving to the hotel, Solange asked Lucretia about Auntie Ebony and Uncle Cotton.
So what's they like?
She said curiously.
I ain't telling, Lucretia replied complacently. Mr. Quillen done invited them to live here and they in their 80s. Once they here, he can't kick them out.
This sounds promising, Quentin thought wryly to himself.
They can't be any worse than Caroline, he responded genially, or her dead boyfriend that floats round on the ceiling.
They can't be any worse than old Grandpa John, Solange put in merrily, or Victor, or Kenny.
Nobody worse than Kenny, Lucretia said decisively. I'm promising they ain't worse than the rest, though.
Maybe we should add a few days to this trip, Quentin suggested quickly. Lupin says we should go to the Black Forest. Apparently that's his new favorite place to prowl.
I don't want to go walk in no woods, Lucretia wailed. It's January. We freeze, Mr. Quilla. We freeze to death.
I'm not taking you to hiking, Quentin replied with a barely concealed smirk. Baden-Baden is a spa town with ruins from Roman baths and a huge wood-carving industry and lots of shopping, he stressed, and some top cultural performances in the Festspielhaus, as well as championship horse racing, if you two want to go, he added generously.
Of course we do, Solange said enthusiastically. We can bet on those horses. It'll be fun.
She wanted to put her money on the prettiest one, Quentin thought with some amusement. This is going to cost me a fortune.
And if you want to ski, he threw in casually, there's the Meliskop, the luxury ski resort.
I want to ski, Lucretia shouted excitedly. Oh, I best I'd be a fantabulous skier, Mr. Quilla. I knows I would.
I know how to ski, Solange announced proudly. Remember when Dad took me and Elizabeth skiing for Elizabeth's 30th birthday? We had the best time.
Didn't Richard break his leg? Quentin asked mildly.
Well, he tried to jump off the lift, Solange replied sulkily. He was scared to ski, but he wouldn't admit it. So he stayed at the bar all day, playing cribbage and whist. But Elizabeth and I made it all the way to the intermediate course in only 3 days. The instructor told us we were super talented.
She finished smugly. I'll just bet he did, Quentin replied dryly.
Yesterday was all totted up in their new snowsuits when they went, Lucretia told him cheerfully. I was hoping Miss Elizabeth find some man to get rid of that drunk.
But Mr. Quilla, she frowned suddenly, nobody knows I here. We better call someone, especially if we stay longer.
Quentin looked uncharacteristically embarrassed for a moment. Well, he said finally, I can't find my cell. It's not in any of my pockets or on my car seat. I think I left it somewhere.
Mine's at home on my dresser, Solange beamed impishly. And I say we don't call anybody at all. Then they can't find us to tell us Kenny's got arrested or B thinks you've got to do some meeting or Tim's in trouble and McGonagall wants me there right now.
I'm game for it, Quentin replied willingly. Shall we run away then, Lucretia?
Lucretia did not ponder this idea for long.
Oh, yes, oh, we should, she screeched.
And maybe you'll figure out the answer to what you were wondering about.
Solange told Quentin coyly. I'll figure it out, he responded seriously. No matter how long it takes or what I've got to do, there's nothing more important to me. Now it was Solange's turn to bust into tears and rush off to the bathroom. It's me, Quentin told the waitress dispassionately when she paused by their table with a puzzled expression. It's this effect I have on women.